Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the second day of the Healthy Money Summit. This is Stephen Dynan, founder of the Shift Network, and I'm just so delighted to be featuring these pioneers who are helping shift our relationship with money. As we know, we just passed through an important portal here of election in the United States, and I think that the deeper question is, how do we shift to healthy, sustainable finances in our world? It's deeper than any particular election. I think Hazel Henderson, who's going to host the session today, is one of the great pioneers of our world today. She's a futurist, evolutionary economist, and author of 9 books, including the Axiom and Nautilus Award-winning book, Ethical Markets, Growing the Green Economy. She's also the founder of Ethical Markets Media and creator of its TV series, and has articles widely published in places like Harvard Business Review, New York Times, Christian Science Monitor. She's really been at the forefront of economic innovation and designing a sustainable economy. Hazel, thanks so much for hosting today's sessions on Healthy Money.
Oh, my pleasure, Stephen. So welcome, everybody, to the Healthy Money Summit, a production of Stephen's Shift Network. And I'm Hazel Henderson. And we're really glad that you're joining us today. And please remember that you're welcome to submit comments on the summit program page, which is found at healthymoneysummit.com/program. And I am really excited to introduce our special guest today, Catherine Collins. And Catherine, it's a great pleasure to have you joining us today. Welcome. And I'm going to just take a couple of minutes to introduce you so people will know what a treat we're in for. So Catherine is founder and CEO of Honeybee Capital, which is an independent research firm dedicated to the belief that pollinating ideas across various fields leads to optimal investment decision-making. And after a very long and successful career at Fidelity Investments, Catherine has set out to reintegrate her investment philosophy with the broader world, traveling as a pilgrim and a volunteer and earning her degree at Harvard Divinity School, and began following lessons from the natural world. And Catherine wants to re-engage in investing as a valued and integrated profession beneficial to our communities and our planet. And as you know, there's a lot of controversy about that right now, and I like the way Catherine just lays it out that she is really committed to investing. Prior to founding Honeybee, Catherine served at Fidelity Management Research Company as head of U.S. equity research and portfolio manager of numerous mutual funds. And every fund that Catherine managed at Fidelity outperformed its regular benchmark during her tenure. She spent 2 years as a program officer for Fidelity Foundations. She's traveled the world as an active volunteer for Habitat for Humanity, and had other volunteer positions with Wellesley College, Common Impact, and Teatian Health. She's an alumna of Wellesley College, and she holds a CFA designation, and recently completed an MTS, Catherine, at Harvard Divinity School.
It's a master's in theological studies.
All right. And her website, which I know you'll enjoy, is www.honeybeecapital.com. So, again, welcome, Catherine. And we're going to be talking about the future of ethical investing based on life's principles. And for full disclosure, Catherine and I agreed that we should tell you that we are co-investors in a company based on life's principles, and we put these principles together in a document which is basically called Ethical Investing Based on Life's Principles. And the company that we are both investors in is Biomimicry 3.8. which is a company founded by my friend Janine Benyus, who is a worldwide author of the book Biomimicry. And so really that's where Catherine and I began to really tune into all the changes that have to happen in our financial markets if we're going to move to a sustainable world. So Catherine, tell us how a bit more about your personal journey from being a mainstream investment manager to this new career that you have.
Sure. Well, thank you, Hazel, for including me today, and thank you for all of your tremendous longstanding leadership in this field. It's just an honor to be here talking with you. So my own journey, I'm happy to say, has finally reconnected my passion for investing with the actual world. What I have always loved about investing at its core is that it's inherently connected with people, with communities, with the needs of our society. And yet what I found over time is that that core of investing has become dwarfed by this giant field of finance. And unfortunately, finance has progressed in a way that is less and less connected to those primary needs, those primary relationships that are at the core. So you have, you know, second and third and fourth derivatives of that primary activity that are now 80 or 90% of a lot of different markets. And you can feel that as a participant in the investing profession, getting pulled further and further away from that direct connection. And what really started to reconnect me was a great talk I heard from Tom Seeley, who's based at Cornell University, who focuses on honeybees and inspired the name of my own company. He was talking about how bees make collective decisions, and as he went through all of the principles that enable the collective decision-making, all of the conditions that make it possible, I realized that they were the exact same conditions that made for great investing. And yet my own time, my own focus had gotten pulled further and further away from that connectedness. And my goal now, using biomimicry and some of the other engagements that you and I have talked about, is to really get back to that core and to reemphasize that core, which I do think is so needed and valuable and integrated into our world.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because I think this is where we strongly connected. You know, I did an article a couple of years ago called Real Economies and the Illusions of Abstraction. And, you know, what you were just saying about all these derivatives, you know, which is paper assets piled on more assets, you know, the kind of thing that really led to the crash in 1929 was exactly that kind of pyramiding on the real economy. You know, there's the real people, you know, making shoes and growing vegetables. And then all of this pyramiding of synthetic assets on the top of it. And, you know, I've just done a couple of reviews on high-frequency trading. You know, mm-hmm. This book just came out called Broken Markets. And I know that this is also the kind of thing that you're talking about and that we're both terribly worried about, you know, where we're so far away from the real world, where these high-frequency traders, they couldn't care less what the company is, how good the management is, you know, what the ethical principles might be. It's just a matter of money, 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 and just trading thousands of times a second.
Right.
What is
right.
it? About 70% of all transactions now on Wall Street are all these computerized driven algorithms. No human involved. And so that I think that that's why you and I resonated so strongly about, hey, you know, let us get back to reality. And the reality is the natural world that supports us.
Absolutely. And I think what I fear is that fictional element, the engineered element of finance, has gotten so big and so frustrating to so many people that there's a real temptation to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so I'm really hopeful that we can highlight through our work together that this core that's still there, even though it's harder and harder to see amidst this great volume of fiction, that core is still really valuable and is worth focusing on.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel totally the same way. And, you know, I'm a typical small investor, and I don't want to invest on Wall Street. I want to find these new little companies that really do understand life's principles, whether they're doing organic growing of food or all of the other ways that we can actually get back to nature.
Mm-hmm. So, absolutely. I think Janine's principles help both of us to identify what types of things fall into the criteria you're talking about.
Well, you know, one of the things that is our passion at Ethical Markets, as you know, is sort of trying to entice all that old money that I call the fossilized money, that's all there, you know, still invested in fossil fuels, coal and oil, and basically we know that if they go on exploiting all of that underground resource, that really at this point we can't afford to, because it's going to warm up the planet, so it's not going to be livable for any of us. And so what we feel is, if only we can get the attention of the mainstream investors that are still running on that old program and thinking that fossil fuels are still going to be part of our future, and we're trying to lure them into the green investments, solar, wind, and energy efficiency, which, as you know, is kind of the real lowest hanging fruit. And what we're happy about is that we've been tracking these private investments since 2007, and our latest report, as you know, is that there's $3.6 trillion of this money, this private investment money, now in the green economy. So.
Right.
So how can we accelerate that shift and get those toxic assets that are all held in coal and oil, get them written down? How
right.
do we do that?
Well, I think there are a lot of pieces to this puzzle, and fortunately I see progress at almost every layer, and I do want to dwell on the data you just cited for a minute, because that's tremendous movement already. And so whenever I'm feeling like things are going too slowly, I try to take an honest look at what's already shifted, and it's really fantastic. I think the first thing is really responsibility of the individual. I talk with so many folks who are frustrated, and the system has gotten to have so many layers to it that they've forgotten they have a choice. And so where my conversations also often start is just reminding folks that these are all systems we created. So first of all, we can change the systems. And if you're not happy with the current system, it's your choice how to participate, whether to participate, you know, to find alternatives, to create alternatives. And just that simple statement really reorients the conversation from sort of defensiveness and guilt and fear to a much more proactive, you know, agency-oriented kind of discussion. So that's the first thing I do. And then I will say a lot of folks still want advice and need advice with what to do with their money. And this is another layer where I'm really happy with some of the progress. There are lots and lots of financial advisors now who are really focused on these exact same themes. And so if 5 years ago or 10 years ago you went to your advisor and said, I want to invest more sustainably, I would think maybe 9 out of 10 of them would have no idea what you were even talking about and pretty little appetite to follow up on it. And now I see so many advisors, even at megacorps, with a sincere personal interest in building out their own capabilities in matchmaking, if you will, between better alternatives that are out there and their clients and what they need and want.
Now, do you think, Catherine, that it's going to be the smaller scale firms, advisory firms, that are going to lead the way on this? I tend to find that, you know, the big pension fund asset managers, you know, that are managing these trillions of millions and millions of dollars, don't seem to have the time or the understanding to focus on what we're talking about. You know, they're out of the old school playbook, you know, the efficient markets and, you know, sort of modern portfolio theory that they learned 20 years ago. And what I worry about now is these pension funds that are investing, well, I would say speculating, in commodity futures and simply driving up the price of food for hungry people around the world. And, you know, we've stated at Ethical Markets, you know, we're a member of the UN Principles of Responsible Investing, and I go on those webinars, you know, with these asset managers and say that, you know, we think it's actually unethical to invest in food commodity futures and all of this. And, you know, anything which is going to cause hardship to poor people.
Right. Well, I think you touched on a couple of really important points there. One is small versus large entities. And I do think in any era of change, the source of at least the initial change is usually smaller, more nimble, more entrepreneurial people and organizations. It's pretty hard to change a very large, very well-established institution or system with the pace that we all would like. So I do see a lot of innovation coming from the small players. But again, my caution there is to maybe reframe that discussion and talk more about how and less about who or what. Because I find folks wanting to pick sides as soon as I frame a discussion, you know, big versus small, and they'll say, I'm only going to invest locally, or I'm only going to deal with small enterprises. Well, there's a reason that there are large enterprises in the world, and it's not all bad. And so to really think through what are we trying to accomplish and how can we get from here to there with everybody participating in maybe different ways, but I want all the money, all the institutions, all the decisions to be incorporating these factors. I'm not satisfied if only individuals dealing with their local, you know, very proactive, creative financial advisor. That's great, but it's only one piece of a big puzzle, and I want all those pieces heading in this direction.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. For years and years, you know, in the ecology movement where I've spent most of my life, there was always this local versus global, and, you know, everything had to be localized. And I used to say, no, it's glocalization. You know, it has to be the whole thing, you know, because if you only look at the local level, you know, and invest in your own organic grower and your community supported agriculture, which is totally wonderful, and you don't pay any attention to the global system and all the rest of it, you're just going to get blindsided. So you absolutely do have to pull back and take a wide shot and always keep an eye on what's happening with the whole system. I mean, that's what I try to do. And so what I have felt for a long time and been sort of encouraging is setting up retraining for these big portfolio managers, the ones, you know, who are managing these gigantic pension funds where they have to place billions of dollars every day and therefore they can hardly think about it, you know. I think there are one or two training programs now, and I've been trying to encourage more at business schools, where we reintroduce asset managers to what you might call the real world.
Yes, and I'm encouraged on that front as well. I think education at all levels is also a crucial piece of the puzzle. And again, I think it's important to emphasize pension funds. You know, they're not entities unto themselves. They're people, and they're people who generally take their fiduciary responsibilities very, very seriously. They really care about their plan beneficiaries and feel responsible for them. And so the question is not, you know, rejecting that whole system or writing it off somehow. The question is how to engage that caring
exactly.
in an appropriate way. And I see so much activity on campuses at this point where a lot of these ideas are much more integrated. They're not even separate, you know, specialty tracks you can take anymore. They're part of all the classes, all the discussions, and I see those graduates going out into the world with this integrated mindset. And so I'm very encouraged. I feel like there are questions coming from outside different organizations, you know, say to the board of a pension fund or the investment committee, and then there are questions bubbling up from within their own organization, folks who have been trained in a different way and are asking different questions than would have been raised even a few years ago.
Yes, I mean, I love to see that, you know, the Harvard students really challenging their economics professors. And I call it the ecology of social change, you know, that you need organizations all along the spectrum, you know, from the real outliers, you know, the Occupy Wall Street people, bless their hearts, you know, all the way through to the people, you know, who are working on the inside and helping to bring the new ideas from within. I mean, I'm thinking of friends of mine in unions and trade unions who are trustees of those union pension funds. And there was a book that one of them wrote a couple of years ago called Up from Wall Street. And they were pointing out what happened was that they would go to their asset manager managing their pension fund and say, hey, here's a wonderful company, solar energy company, or here's a wonderful company, wind power, or, you know, energy efficiency or whatever. And what would happen is the asset manager would be very kind of haughty and psych them out. You know, and
right.
say, no, you don't understand what you're talking about. You know, we're the experts here. And so what the trade union people were doing is helping their trustees sitting on the board of their pension funds to actually face down the asset managers. And they would say, I'm sorry, but I'm representing the owners of this pension fund and the beneficiaries, and if you won't go and be retrained, guess what? We're going to fire
right.
you.
Right.
So, so that becomes the last resort.
Yeah, well, and I think what you're highlighting here is a question almost of translation into, you know, different institutional language, if you will. So I'll say for myself, you know, if a shareholder came to me when I was managing large funds and said, you know, hey, I have this great stock idea, it's very easy to dismiss. You know, that's a small conversation, right? It's very easy
yeah.
to find reasons not to engage. But if someone comes and says, I am really concerned about our sources of energy, and I think it impacts every investment you talked about today, that's a much bigger conversation. And if you take it even a layer higher than that, as you just mentioned, and say, I am here representing the owners, the people whose money this is. You know, it's my
yeah.
money. It's my choice. You know, that's an even higher level still. And so I think to just recognize those different levels and be thoughtful about how and where we can productively engage with one another is really key, because from a trustee standpoint, it's totally fine to dismiss any one specific suggestion you get. It's not fine at all when someone is questioning your fiduciary responsibilities not to take that seriously and investigate and put thought and resources behind it. So all the rules in these systems we've created, they're not all bad. They all give you some sort of tool. And to recognize that and work with it and leverage it, as opposed to bashing your head against the wall, is a lot more fun.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's get deeper into what we mean by life's principles. And let's mention a little bit more about the company that we both invested in, Biomimicry. Now, the reason that I invested in Biomimicry is because, first of all, I really believe that this is where investing has to end up, going with nature. only investing in those activities that will be a part of the natural ecosystem, so that don't create pollution and recycle all materials. You know, we have our principles, which people can look at, and they can I can give people the website to look at that. But basically, that's what we're talking about, is an economy which totally mimics natural processes. So there is no waste. And they tend to be more decentralized. And let's explain to people a little bit more. I mean, actually, this company, Biomimicry, is really a global education company. And it's training people and consultants all over the world in biomimicry and life's principles. And so that's why I was attracted to it, because, you know, what we do at Ethical Markets is very similar, you know, sort of global education. And our product, as Janine and I were talking, we realized that basically we're in the cultural DNA business.
I love that phrase. Yeah. And the concept that automatically goes with that of replication and building out and connection is really wonderful.
Yeah.
And we should mention, maybe for folks who are on the line, the Biomimicry site is a very, very rich one. So it's biomimicry.net. And a lot of what we're discussing today can be found in depth on that site as well. I think my attraction here, Hazel, is very similar to yours. I just felt, again, after this long period of struggle, really, and feeling more and more disconnected from where my own profession seemed to be heading, when I look at these principles, they are how the world actually functions. And so there's such a deep truth to them that is completely unrefutable. You can go back to these principles in almost any kind of system, any kind of organization, any kind of question you have, and they tend to point you in the right direction, not because they're wisdom falling from heaven, but because this is the actual functioning of the world and how it's explained. And what I love is I can translate these principles into almost any other language. So evolve to survive. Well, when Janine talks about this, she's talking about it in a very rich, ecological, biologically rooted way. But I can go into any company in the world and say evolve to survive and help them understand that from the perspective of their own business in a way that they can hear. And once it's heard, then you can step back and explain how this is not a fancy HBR article that just came out. This is a deep principle that governs the entire natural world. And so when they're thinking about it, it's not a game of PowerPoints and tactics and sales forces. It's a question of how you want to be in the world. That's a much more interesting question.
And much more deeply spiritual. I mean, didn't we have
Absolutely.
A wonderful time at our gathering where we put together those principles? It was very, very inspiring. And I mean, it's also common sense and so liberating somehow. You know, like, okay, yes, nature says be resourceful and efficient. And adapt to changing conditions and integrate development with growth. You know, be locally attuned and responsive.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, use life-friendly chemistry. I mean, I learned so much about, you know, that I didn't know about the periodic table, that you really shouldn't use all those nasty heavy elements because nature doesn't use them. And
it's a very short list.
Yeah, I mean, nature's been at it for 3.8 billion years. And, you know, here we are, one of 30 million species on this planet, all working and surviving and thriving together. And why wouldn't we want to follow that success?
Right. Well, I find it so comforting and so inspiring at the same time. So to continue on your example, you know, if you look around like, wow, everything I see is mostly carbon and some oxygen and a couple other smaller things. If we
yeah.
could do all that with just those two things, surely I don't need 100-slide deck and, you know, sourcing from the far ends of the earth to do this little simple business project I have ahead of me.
Exactly.
So I find it a wonderful orientation for all I do, and again, inherently connected in a much deeper sense than a lot of traditional business and investing advice would be.
Oh, absolutely. And you remember, too, where we all sat around realizing, my gosh, each one of us in our own human body mind, we are a biome. And,
yep.
You know, we're actually nothing more than collections of microbes. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it?
Well, and that's the greatest thing to me, these principles. I can apply them to human-created organizations. I can apply them to ecosystems. I can apply them to myself. They work at every possible level. And again, I draw such great comfort in that it's just such a wonderful guideline for how to think about effective and beneficial functioning in the world.
You know, I was very lucky the way I was brought up because my mother grew all of our food. We grew up in a little town in Britain, and she used to take us every day to the pier to buy the fish from the fishers. And we used to go picking wild berries and all of that kind of thing. So I grew up learning that nature was abundant and that it's always been very comforting to me. However crazy I thought human beings were getting, you know, with nuclear power and stuff like that, that, well, nature bats last, and Mother Nature is in charge, thank heaven.
Right.
So, I mean, it was a very amazing thing, really, just before this election when Hurricane Sandy came along, and all of those climate deniers, 75 members of Congress who had laughed at the idea of climate change, and suddenly Mother Nature was saying, hey, you know, I'm the one in charge here.
Yes, and I think, and this is something that was an unexpected benefit of my divinity school studies. We talked a lot about human agency and why it's so important for us to feel some sense of agency, but agency is not the same as total control. And I do think a lot of the challenges in our current financial system are based on this false premise of control. And what my divinity studies gave me was a much more sympathetic way of looking at that as, you know, yes, it's short-sighted and should be more thoughtful and all sorts of other things, but it's also just as deeply rooted within us, this desire for control, and to begin with an acceptance that there are limits to our control and boundary conditions on Earth, if you will, I think is a much more appropriate, much more humble starting point. And again, I'm so encouraged that it's just now beginning to be accepted to have a starting point like that in a large enterprise or in a very competitive investment firm, for example. To say what you don't know is now a pretty important part of a lot of firms' investment processes, whereas when I was coming up through that system, you were supposed to know everything, or at least pretend you did.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, it's a really awful cultural environment to set, because until you admit there are things you don't know, not because you're a lazy analyst, but because they are genuinely unknowable.
Yes.
That's the biggest part of decision making.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, what happened in 2008 with the financial crash was all about that. It was all about the idea that, hey, we've got control. We have these wonderful risk management tools like value at risk and all the rest of it, and we can predict everything. And then, of course, when it all came apart, they were all saying, well, how could we have known? It was a perfect storm. You know, I remember talking to Nassim Taleb about this, you know, his book, The Black Swan. And I said, these weren't black swans.
No,
they were just that they had blinders on. They had decided they were going to externalize, quote unquote, the cost of the people and put them off the balance sheet. And so they came back to hit them. But, right. You know, there was nothing that couldn't have been, I mean, I have to say that I was predicting that for years and years, far ahead of, you know, of when it really happened. But my timing was wrong. Yes, my timing was wrong. But eventually, eventually they got their comeuppance. They weren't in
right.
control.
Well, and I think, I think partly because of that experience, it's unfortunate that that was necessary, but a much more common question now is one that I have always loved to ask, especially folks who are very quantitatively oriented, very technically oriented. If they ever were showing me a big, fancy quantitative model, and I would never understand all the programming and algorithms that went into it, I would just ask them, tell me under what conditions this model won't work. Tell me, you know, what is it good for? Tell me what it's not good for.
Good for
and
you.
The folks who can't answer that second question, it shows me they've forgotten this principle we were just talking about. Every model, they're fine. I love quantitative models, but they're good as tools. You know, they're not magic. They're not religion.
Right.
They're just tools. And to know, you know, oh, this model is a hammer. So if I need to saw something, I really shouldn't be looking at this. It's a good framework to use, and I think folks with their own investment decisions, with financial advisors, with anyone involved in this whole system, to ask that question is a really simple way to see, you know, is this a person who's really thought through what they're recommending to you? Or
right, are they blowing smoke? Yes.
Okay.
No, I think that's a wonderful piece of advice. To when you're talking to your investment advisor, you know, under what conditions is this thing not going to work?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Now, here's another question, too, before we open this up to people who may want to ask us questions. I am looking, and I know you are, too, at the true biomimicry, as we understand it, really based on life's principles. And then there's the old control trip of artificial life and artificial intelligence. And this is a very mechanistic view where they're trying to mimic biology by creating life forms in test tubes. And
right.
as you know, Janine and I feel very strongly that that's not the way to go. So how do you come down on that, Catherine?
Well, I definitely share your concern. And I think, again, though, the question is, okay, well, what do I do with that concern? And so when I find myself in an environment where there are folks really advocating for that line of progress, again, I just try to ask the question and ask it in a way so that it really can be heard. So the same question as I have with some of the models we just talked about, you know, tell me, what do you think the real risk is here? I spent a lot of time with some large agriculture companies a few years ago talking about monocrops. And, you know, in theory, they're much more efficient. And so what I wanted to hear was not why they were right and why I was wrong. I wanted to hear that they really had thought it through and understood the other side of the story, understood the negative potential. And to me, that's a much healthier starting point. It leads to an open-ended conversation and debate as opposed to just picking sides. And I stay on my side and you stay on your side and we never actually engage. So
yeah.
I'm most encouraged and most focused on that engagement.
Well, you know, just to sort of where I'm coming from on the efficiency model, the way I always try to deal with it, you know, is to point out that economists' model of efficiency is always based on externalizing costs in the system to other people. And once you internalize all of those costs, you find actually that John Maynard Keynes was right in terms of global trade, you know, and he always said it's much more efficient to have to trade the recipes than it is the cakes and the cookies and the biscuits. And,
right.
you know, basically, that's always been my problem with economists, that they never really understood how to measure efficiency. So theoretically, they always turn out to be wrong, actually, and the only model of efficiency that I ever use is thermodynamic efficiency, which is based there again in the real world. So I think it's almost time for us to see if anybody would like to jump in on this, who's listening to us. So can we open up the conversation at this point?
We can indeed. This is Ben Hart from the Shift Network. Happy to help you, Hazel.
Thank you, Ben.
So those of you who are on the phone, you can go ahead and press *2 to raise your hand if you have a question. Hit *2. And then if you're on the webcast, you can go ahead and write your question in there. And while people are raising their hands, *2 again, we have a few questions here from the webcast. One for you is, what are some of the biomimicry principles specifically? Up to now, you've been talking in a general way. Could you please continue to detail them, and more specifically, how they prompt your investment decisions?
Don't we love that question, Catherine? Why don't you jump in on it, and then I'll add anything.
Sure. Well, I have the actual list right here, the short list of life's principles, and we've alluded to many of them, but I'll read through it quickly and maybe give you one or two examples. So the first is evolve to survive. That is replicating what works and integrating unexpected development. The second one is be resource efficient, both materials and energy. The third is adapt to changing conditions, maintaining integrity through renewal, not through stasis, which I think is a really key differentiator of biomimicry and life's principles as opposed to a lot of management principles. So maintain integrity through renewal. Embody resilience through variation, redundancy, decentralization, the opposite, really, of what a lot of efficiency theory would tell you to do, and incorporate diversity. Number four is be locally attuned and responsive, using readily available materials and cultivating cooperative relationships. And the fifth is use life-friendly chemistry, as we just discussed, breaking down products into benign and simple constituents. And again, what I find so comforting here is when I look at the companies I've seen and the individuals I've seen who I really respect and who have built genuinely resilient and long-lasting enterprises that can thrive, they follow these principles. What I see in the shorter term are a lot of folks who are focused on maximizing as opposed to optimizing. And you can maximize on one output, say quarterly profit or short-term investment gains. You can maximize on that output for a finite period of time, but all along the way, you're sacrificing all of these other important dimensions, and so you can't keep it up, whether it's an individual or an institution. And so what I talk with a lot of organizations now about is optimizing and what's on their list. What are the key things that they feel like they really have to keep in alignment on any given day? And this translates very naturally to most successful business people. You know, if you talk with them about product development, that's nothing but an endeavor in long-term optimization of resources and hopefully benefits to community, to customers, to employees. And yet they don't frame it in those terms. So again, it's a great chance to translate from a very naturally rooted system into a more of a human system.
And really, the way we look at it in the investing movement that I've been a part of for many, many years is basically that you need many bottom lines. You know, the whole idea of the single bottom line, which is the old model, you know, just maximize profit for the investors, on a quarterly basis, where we talk about the triple bottom line, where you have to bring in governance and you have to bring in the social impacts and all the stakeholders and the environment. And so that's the kind of expansion which makes it possible to optimize investments rather than just these sort of single, just let's maximize the money in the short run. And of course, you know, this is also to do with the fact that we need to understand that money is not the same as wealth. And we have a TV show that you can watch, an hour-long TV show at ethicalmarkets.tv called The Money Fix. And we have to remember that money is simply an accounting unit, very, very useful invention, but it just tracks the real value and the real wealth, and that is talented entrepreneurial human beings cooperating and competing both in balance, using nature's resources as sparingly as possible. That's the real wealth, and the money is just an audit system to track it. And somehow we got the two confused, and that's one of the things now which we see very clearly. You know, we see money being printed on TV, and we know that that isn't the same as growing a healthy economy.
Right.
If you want to actually go into details with the life's principles, you can go to ethicalmarkets.com, and we have it right there on the home page and under our Transforming Finance section. So it's right there. Do we have some other questions or comments?
We do indeed. We have quite a few other questions here for you. This one is saying, does your advice all come down to investing more in green energy, community-based mutually supportive economies, and local foods? How does one evaluate what are the most beneficial investments?
Well, for me, it really does. I mean, this is where this is the kind of thing that we cover on Ethical Markets, and we have lots of pages on different aspects of this: green technologies, energy efficiency, and so on, biomimicry, and so on and so forth. And so, definitely, that is our beat, and what we are looking to see. That's the transformation that we're looking to see, is beyond fossil fuels and a green economy. Really. Built on those free photons that come in every day from the sun. So how would you answer that, Catherine?
Well, I think I agree with what you just said, Hazel, and I think energy is such a crucial piece of the puzzle that it enables a lot of the other things I'm focused on. But the question implies, I think, a very narrow sort of tactical implementation of what we've been talking about. And again, my biggest focus is to make sure that every investment, every time, no matter what sector, no matter what setting, these principles are applied. I have been pretty active in looking at local food enterprises here in New England the last year or two, and I have to say, just because it's local doesn't make it good. There are a lot of wasteful and unoptimized enterprises that are local food. And so I worry every time we try to take shortcuts, if you will. You know, every solar investment is not a good investment.
Right.
It's not even a good idea. You know, some solar investments are actively destructive, you know, using way more materials than they ever will generate in benefit. And so what we're advocating for here, I think, is a more complicated but really a much more legitimate mindset to take towards your investments, looking at these principles and seeing how they apply to a specific enterprise or endeavor and seeing where there are holes. You know, it's hard to find the perfect endeavor, but if at least you can identify where work needs to be done and encourage progress in that direction, that's a big win. So I'm looking not for engagement in very specific sectors. I'm looking for engagement with these ideas across every decision, because I think once you engage with these questions, you can't help but head towards the types of opportunities you just highlighted.
And it's such fun. It's such an incredible learning experience. Well, in the Green Transition Scoreboard, we really stick to the deep green stuff. We exclude a lot of categories of so-called green energy that don't fit our criteria. You know, we don't look at any agriculturally based biofuels, for example, because of the problem of, you know, taking away from food. You know, the only biofuels that I think are going to eventually be viable are ones grown on seawater. So, you know, we are very careful about those criteria. We don't have anything in nanotech, because although nanotechnology is a very attractive area, there's almost no good standards yet for nanotech, and it's already in lots and lots of products, so we stay away from that. So, we are very strategic. And we do believe that there's many of these investments are great, but you really do have to go in, as Catherine says, to the details. You know, which ones don't work, and which ones do. Any more questions out there? Because we are coming almost, let's see where we are. We've just got 10 more minutes.
Yeah, we do have some more questions here. This is a quick clarification question. They're saying, this is a great session, thank you. Could you please spell out the biomimicry website address again?
It's biomimicry.net. Is the one which is public access, and it's a fabulous site. That's biomimicry.net. biomimicry.net. And the life's principles are also at www.ethicalmarkets.com. And we are partners with the biomimicry company.
Great. Thank you, Hazel. So here's another question for you both. So what would be different about a retirement plan's investment mix for, say, a 25-year-old if they're following your approach? And similarly, what sort of investments would be appropriate for a low-saving 65-year-old with a steady pension from a government career?
Go for it, Catherine.
Well, I think the very question actually illuminates a really crucial piece of our system that is a little bit out of alignment. So I know when I go to my financial advisors, the first thing they pull out is those pie charts saying you should have X percent in equities, X percent in fixed income. And not only are those not very interesting to me, but they're not getting at the appropriate questions. So I could have nothing but equities and have good income generating properties, very, very stable investments, very, very low risk. Or I could have a very small proportion in equities and be taking gigantic risk, having all kinds of crazy stuff in my portfolio. So I think, again, some of the shortcuts we've created are not fulfilling their original purpose. So my question, if I were a 25-year-old seeking to put together my investment principles for the first time, is to really focus on them as principles. What kinds of things do you want to be fostering in the world? And let's not skip it, what kinds of needs do you and your family actually have? Because that is a key piece to resilience and sustainability as well. And matchmaking between the two of them is a really fun exercise. So I think for an early, for someone really early in their career, you can find some really creative alternatives now that are not so creative as to be irresponsible. And so there are lots of advisors out there. I'm not one of them, so I'm being cautious here, who can point you towards different funds, different investment firms, different types of approaches that can point you in this direction. For someone closer to their retirement, I think, likewise, I'm so encouraged by the fact that I can fill out the grid now, if you will, with real, live, proven investments in almost every category. And even when I started this work 5 to 10 years ago, if I had, what I do is I take an issue, say local food, and I describe all the different ways I could engage with that, right? I can do it as a consumer, I can do it as a citizen, as an advocate, I can do it as an investor with my financial resources. And as an investor, I could invest in local food, I could not invest in mega food. There's a long list of different ways I could approach it. I could buy a farm, I could buy a share in a farm. And then I try to fill out across the top of that all of the traditional financial vehicles. So you have mutual funds, you have hedge funds, you have currency products of different sorts. And I'm actually really encouraged now, even if you just do a quick Google search on any given cross-section of those two things, there's usually a pretty robust set of things to look at. I don't feel so much like I need to create everything myself anymore. And that's just been a tremendous advance in the last, I'd say, 5 years. So that's a vague answer, but I hope it gives some sort of process that you might think about.
So any other questions?
Yeah, we have a question here. How do you think we can best use the new SEC rules on crowdfunding?
Oh, that's a very good one, and one we're very interested in. We are tracking all of these issues on crowdfunding at ethicalmarkets.com. And we have a page on crowdfunding. And initially, I think there's only one state in the USA where you actually can do investing using crowdfunding sites. All across the country, you still have to offer some kind of a premium, or you have to do it as donations, as they do like on Indiegogo. But in other countries, investing via crowdfunding platforms is quite legal. So there are quite a few of them that there are out there. But one of the things that sort of worried me at the beginning is that the old broker-dealer networks around the SEC were trying to spin crowdfunding, and the original idea of crowdfunding was really to let small investors in who could not qualify under the old SEC rules. And what seemed to be happening is that the broker-dealers were trying to sort of preempt the process, and so that's kind of what's going on now. But there are a lot of articles there on that page of ours, which you can take a look at. I'm just about to post another one, another newsletter on this. And there is a conference coming up on crowdfunding in Atlanta on December 10th that I think you can find on our events page that I'm going to be speaking at. And mostly this is about women transforming Wall Street, and a lot of them have dropped out of Wall Street and are in the crowdfunding area now. So hopefully you can get some ideas from that site of ours.
I would just add, I work with a lot of social entrepreneurs, and this is one of far and away the most interesting areas for startups right now. So crowdfunding for investors, as opposed to crowdfunding for projects. There are, last I saw, between 300 and 350 companies already starting up in this arena. They have a lot of detail yet to work out in terms of the legislation. And again, I would echo Hazel's caution. On the one side, you don't want this all to be sort of co-opted by traditional finance. On the other hand, the reason things are regulated is there was massive fraud in the first place. And so, to not, again, throw out the baby with the bathwater is key. I will say, as crowdfunding evolves, I am much more inclined to look at debt-oriented crowdfunding, where you make an investment and earn an interest rate on that investment, as opposed to equity-based crowdfunding. Is inherently a lot more difficult, a lot more regulated, a lot more risky. And so as we're monitoring this evolution the next few years, I'm personally inclined more to start with very simple debt-oriented engagements as a way to get started.
Any more? This would probably have to be a final question.
I think we've actually come to the end here, so I don't see any more.
All right, wonderful. Well, I just really have enjoyed this so much, Catherine. And we didn't get into this whole area of the maker revolution that is so well described in Chris Anderson's new book, Makers, which I've just done a review of, which will show up in a couple of days. But that's another area I think that Catherine and I have both been interested in, because when you're interested in investing, you do have to keep ahead as much as you can of all of these trends at every level. including the level of actually this manufacturing of stuff. You know,
right.
3D printing that's going on right now. And so if anyone is interested in that, I think that it is going to be a whole new kind of way of doing business, which might bring back the more cooperative and the more local, the more artisanal kind of companies, where you don't need an enormous market, you don't need mass production, you can do niche marketing.
Right, and I see that approach, Hazel, as a perfect fit with all we've been discussing, because it fits right in with life's principles, being more adaptable, more locally attuned, more resource efficient, et cetera. So it all knits together in a wonderful way.
It does, yes. So anyway, I am so happy to have had this conversation with you, Catherine. Thank you so much for everything you do. You're a shining light in the investment community and a terrific leader for all of us.
And,
so,
and
again, thank you.
thank you
all for listening. What a great session with the amazing Catherine Collins. So until next time, I'm Hazel Henderson, and I'll be back with John Fullerton at 2 p.m. East Coast time, an hour from now, and we'll look forward to it. Thank you so much. Bye now.